Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And so, Cindy, this week, it's kind of All-America Week.
You sound really sexy today, Tony. What's going on with your voice?
My voice is scratchy. I'm sorry.
What are you sorry about? I'm sure all the women out there are swooning right now.
Yeah, swoon. Uh-huh, that's why you listen to public radio.
And the topic, I mean, could it get any better?
But
I mean,
seriously,
three things.
Okay.
Ooh, so three interviews.
So I have a silly need to link things into themes, okay?
I like it. That's fun.
And what are the three all-American beverages?
Beer. Whiskey. Right.
Whiskey.
And coffee. Coffee or tea, but we're going to go with coffee.
Coffee. Be realistic.
Coffee.
It was not a Boston coffee party.
Okay. No, but people started drinking coffee around the time of the Boston Tea Party in this country.
Exactly.
It was predominantly tea consumption prior to that. So, yeah, there you go.
We're a reactionary, rebellious culture.
Mm, yeah, apparently in so many ways.
Because of that, and we have an All-American chef.
Yeah, me?
On the program.
Well, now we're talking about me. All right,
yeah.
Cool. I am All-American.
Exactly. You are All-American via...
Bob Wolf and Gene Wolf.
Pennsylvania and Virginia and Indiana and South Carolina and...
Yep.
Right, so what we're going to do is we have a few guests on, because we always talk about food and wine, which is the music and dancing that I will admit makes me happiest.
Absolutely, it's just everything about it. Food and wine is like, don't you get so excited when you're about to have a good meal? It doesn't have to be a great meal.
I do.
Anything that you love, yeah.
Absolutely, but sometimes I love, you know, I love some kind of a sticky bun, and I want coffee.
Oh, for sure.
With that.
Oh, my God. Coffee is a beautiful beverage.
And sometimes I want some kind of ridiculous sandwich, and I want beer with that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And sometimes my day is imperfect, and I want whiskey with that.
All right.
So we have coming on with us from Waverly Brewing. It's a new local brewer, John Marsh and Roy Fischera, the brewer.
That's exciting.
From...
Happy
Ceremony Coffee, real talented roasters in the area, in the region.
Yes.
Vincent Iatesta, who is going to come on. And we'll ask him all the basic, you know, we know nothing questions, because we know food and wine a lot better than we know these things.
Yeah, right.
And from High West Distillery, which this guy figured out exactly what to do. He put a distillery in a ski resort.
Yeah, that's like a dream.
In Park City, Utah.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I can't wait to talk to him.
David Perkins. And so... We're going to spend a little bit of time today on that all-American beverage trio of beer and whiskey and coffee. So our first guest, Cindy, we have from the local brewer I mentioned, Waverly Brewing.
I'm so excited you all are here.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming and talking with
us. Thanks for having us.
So John Marsh is here, and it's John's project, John's brewery, right?
I'm one of the partners, yeah.
Okay. And Roy Fischera is the brewer.
Hi.
Hi, Roy.
And I was told that he didn't really speak, so that was a big statement right there, wasn't it?
That's about all you're going to get out of him. You might, once you start talking about food, you're definitely going to get a lot of him.
Okay, now there we go. Yeah.
So one of the reasons we're doing this program, we're doing a program on three beverages that are sort of the all-American beverages, beer, whiskey, and coffee, they don't fit under food and wine. And since the program's been food and wine, but we're in America and everyone cares about these things so much. Seems silly not to talk about it sometime. Mm-hmm. So maybe explain to the all-American chef, she knows why she cooks. Explain why you make beer.
Well, I think beer, like food, makes people feel good. And really, beer is a food. So, you know, way back when people couldn't drink the water, they were making beer. So it was one of the safest way to go to kill bacteria. Don't drink the local water.
There you go.
Isn't that one of the real sort of... Questions,
nice,
is it beer first or bread first, right?
Right.
Once they figured out what yeast did.
Yes. And sometimes they'd throw the bread in the water to make the beer.
So how did you guys get the brewery project started?
Well, we met probably about 2 years ago. And we started off as a group, very weird group of people. And we all collaborated and decided we wanted to do a project together. And Roy brought in... beer one time as a friend, one of our partners as a friend, and I knew Roy from years ago, but he came in and he had beer, and we tried it, and it tasted really good, but it didn't taste like homebrew. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't have that, like, homebrew, I have to sieve this through my teeth kind of feel. And and there's sometimes you get homebrew and there's a little sediment in it. There's, you know, there's a little of that. But he had this great beer, and we all kind of said, "Where'd you get this?" And he's like, "I made this." And we all had this light bulb moment where we're like, well, you know, it's pretty good projections, a pretty good business to get involved in. And Baltimore's really booming right now with the beer scene. And we thought, like, this would be a great project to get involved in. And then once we kind of saw the recipes and how inventive he was with his beers, but not too off the line where it doesn't seem very drinkable. His beers are very drinkable, that we thought, well, this is something we could get behind. So we started off, and then it was a year of being in our space and kind of figuring that out and going over through permits and going, you know, how that all feels. Sure. So
how long does it take to get the beer started?
Brew days take about 8 hours, and then 5 to 7 days for fermentation, and then 2 or 3 days really to brighten up in a conditioning tank. And really, if you're that thirsty, we could push a beer out in 10 or 12 days and have it ready to drink in our tap room.
So how about a little basic primer on beer? So what are the types that you, at least for you guys, what are the types that you produce? And what do you maybe aspire to produce? What are the differences between beer and ale and stout? And
Well, that's going back to square one. We're big on American styles. So myself, my favorite styles are the hoppy styles, which probably, you know, just a lot of people just turn their radios off right now because I love hops. You know, it's basically the flower of a trailing vine that grows wild. But as far as the basics go, you know, you've got your ales, which is a top fermenting yeast. They live on the top of the beer while they're doing their work. And your lagers are your bottom fermented yeasts, and they live in colder beer. So the Germans made that. The Germans and the Bohemians and the European styles were heavily lager.
We have a variety of different types of ales right now, and I think what's interesting is that there's a larger flavor profile from a lighter blonde all the way through right now that we have a stout. So we're looking at different, when someone comes in and they're really not into the microbrew thing yet, we're like, well, what do you like to drink? And if they say, I drink Amstel Light, well, we have a red ale for them, or we have something that's sort of a starter to some training wheels to get. So it's more approachable. We're trying to be more approachable and more community focused about, like, hey, come in. This is not that hard to wrap your head around. You know, again, we use the word approachable. We just want to have, like, hey, even if you drink Miller Lite, try our blonde ale. It's going to be around 5% alcohol. It's going to be easy to drink, and it's probably something you can do after you mow the lawn. You know, it's just going to be a really easy drinkable beer.
Well, beer, like bread, you want it to be fresh, isn't that? I mean, right. To me, that seems like the whole ball game.
It's true.
Because I'm, as much as I take a lot of people who are novices to wine through all kinds of, you know, hurdles and pathways and everything else to get to some very interesting thing that they're going to like, sometimes you just want something in your glass and you want it to be good.
Right.
And so the whole idea that at least if it's fresh and it's well made and it's made from good product, you can trust it. That appeals to me. I walked into a store to buy beer, which I never do. I walked in to buy a six pack of something to take it home and drink, you know, one a month.
Right.
There is that food thing that I need it for.
Right.
And but I walked in and everything is crazy designs. And from the last time I was in a store looking at beer, even 5 years ago, all of the European labels that I was used to seeing are gone. And it's all microbrew. And a lot of the stuff may be local, but there's also stuff from all over the place. But I can't even read the sides of the packaging from all of the design stuff that's going on the things. And it's kind of nuts. I almost want to see a Simpsons version of, like, Duff beer.
Right, just as beer.
Just know that, like, exactly.
Light beer, right.
I'm comforted. It's funny. I'm looking at Roy's hat with the bright red front and the blue, like, super easy logo on right. It. I'm like, if you just put a beer, when it comes time to actually put it in cans and just put it in a can with that on it and don't say anything else, People know it's beer.
Beer.
It's fresh.
Brown ale.
You know.
There you go.
I think somehow that would be very, yeah, I'd be very comforted by that, because I was the same way that some people pick up a giant wine list. They're like, oh my God, I don't want to do this work. And I feel like beer all of a sudden is exploding into that. You have to do all this work, and yet they're like beer smarts.
Well, you have to have beer smarts, but I think once you learn sort of what type of alcohol level do you want in your beer, and how much hops do you want in your beer, and what kind of flavor do you want?
But do you want more hops or less different times of the year, or with different dishes, or?
Well, absolutely. You know, yeah.
For me, if you're selling to me, sell me something that's very clean, slightly bitter, and that is a little floral, mm-hmm. and I'm always going to like it, and not too much alcohol.
Right. So, I mean, instantly I think of like a British bitter or something like that. That's, when you describe.
And that's exactly that what sentence. I typically yeah. like the best.
Right. And I would say that would go great with a burger, or it would go great with chili. But I could also say sometimes when you want that extra kick and you get a big, bright American IPA that tastes like grapefruit when it finishes, I think that would also go with something like, you know.
Grapefruit.
Something, I don't know, Thai-inspired or something with a lot of citrus in it, because you got complement.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And you got mm-hmm. contrast.
Because if you have like even a double IPA or something that's really hoppy, it's generally going to go pretty well with spicy foods, but you're going to have mouth attack at the same exact time, because I'm not much of a hops on the hop side of things, but I like brown ales and I like red ales and I like a sweeter beer. But to me, hops always kind of feels like it deadens my palate, but other people have different palates, so they'll like a hops feel to go with something either very sweet or very spicy, and so that will play off with each other. And we were just talking, coming here, just saying, even cooking with something that has a lot of hops into it, you'll have that flavor profile come through on a lot of things, that it won't all cook off. The alcohol cooks off, but the actual flavor will stay with it.
Well, that's what's interesting to me as a chef, because I make gumbo. I make duck gumbo with a dark roux, and I used to put Guinness in. And so I'm sitting here thinking, gosh, I wonder which one of your beers I would put in, you know, a dark, you know, to replace a Guinness, that sort of dark, rich, almost to me, molasses-y, I guess.
Right.
We make a buckwheat brown that's more probably along Tony's, you know, what he just described. It's sweeter. It doesn't have a lot of hop bite in it, and it's got like kind of a chocolatey, nutty afterward. Oh, yeah, finish to it, I would say. And I would use that, because if you're cooking gumbo and you're actually simmering for hours, any hops that are in that sauce or in your stock pot are going to increase, because you're really reducing.
Yes.
So you're going to taste the bitterness at the end, but with something that doesn't have a lot of hops in it, you're going to bring out those other complementary flavors.
So, Chef, what kind of beer do you like?
Oh, my God.
There it
Tony,
is.
Tony, you know.
There it is.
I mean, it's right. just, this is why we're divorced.
Right.
I don't know.
You don't know because you mostly like haven't liked beers.
Beer, yes, I don't. Well, no, I don't. I won't drink it.
So if you guys are going to try to convert her, what would you put in front of her? What would you propose?
I would start with that one, the buckwheat brown.
Okay.
It's sweet. It tastes like cookies.
Sounds like I'm coming to Waverly Brewing
Tastes like
Company.
Cookies.
Oh, okay. Beer that tastes like cookies? That sounds good to me.
Well, let's get at this. So you don't like beer because of the carbonation, because of the taste?
No, or it's the taste.
You like champagne plenty for carbonation.
Yeah, no, I love carbonation.
Okay. But some people like, you know, if they're going to... Okay.
Yeah, for sure. No, I haven't had any beer since I was in college.
I was going to say, was it college? Did college do you in?
Well, yeah, high school and
college.
So
it was like Old Milwaukee.
You know, it's that and the moonshine that I was probably drinking at the same time. So it's like, you know, hey, man.
It was Indiana,
right? I am from Indiana.
See, that's so funny. It's so funny to hear that, because I know college kind of ruins people when it comes to beer.
I didn't used to drink any liquor either. I mean, as an adult, I have only ever drank wine or champagne. I until recently, I finally started drinking some sort of liquor, but I hated that too. So, yeah, but no, I mean, I think that's the difference, is that, I mean, it's a very different world now. Yeah. And when Roy's talking about, well, one of the beers has chocolate in it, I'm like, oh, well, maybe I should start drinking beer again. Sounds good. No, it'd be fun to try.
Yeah.
And my thought for this topic really literally came from standing at the wall of beer that was not decipherable. And thinking, oh, good Lord.
Well, everyone's trying to find their niche and on the shelf, you know, like any other product. If you go look at any grocery store, there's 27 different types of anything. And with beer, it's interesting because right now it's such a business that you can be in your local marketplace and you can be in the Mid-Atlantic, and it's easier to do things now because of you don't have to pay for the entire infrastructure. You can bring in something to do the canning for you and lease that.
That's
you
cool.
can bring in the cans, and you can it's all done so much easier in the process. If you want a bottle, you can still do that very easily. There's a cost associated with it, but what I think brands are trying to do now is try to distinguish themselves, like you said, like you saw on the shelf. And there's so many different types, and you just look at it and you're like, I just want beer.
I just wanted to stab myself.
But I do the same thing when I when someone hands me a wine menu. I, unfortunately, on the other side, look at it,
like,
and I'm like, could someone just get me something, and
but
this
least,
is what I like.
Right, but at least the names are names of, like, it's this place, and it's from this year, and so this guy made it. You can. They were all so loud. I was like, oh, my gosh.
Right.
I turned into an old guy.
I agree. I won't buy a beer sometimes if I don't like the label.
Booked by its cover, really.
Yeah, sort of.
I'm terrible. No, I'm telling you, I'm telling you.
Right, I'm a little disappointed
you gotta
in that
You got to do the can of your hat.
It just says beer.
It just says beer. I'm serious. If you do that, I will always buy it.
Well, I wish you all the luck. I hope that you all do very, very well. I'm
Thank
excited
you.
For
yeah,
you.
Yeah, appreciate this.
Thank you.
Interesting to get the lesson. Thanks so much for coming on.
All right,
it was
Thank
a pleasure.
You for us. Yeah.
All the best.
Appreciate it.
When we come back on Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll have Vincent Iatesta from Ceremony Coffee and David Perkins from High West Distillery. All of that and more on Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine on WYPR. Welcome back to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And so we, in our series of sort of all-American beverage interviews, we have our second person today is David Perkins from High West Distillery in Utah. David, how are you?
Well, I'm wonderful. Thank you. It's good to be here.
A distillery in Utah is kind of counterintuitive. Exactly how'd you make that happen?
Well, at the end of the day, my wife and I were hoping to live in the Rocky Mountains, and I popped the question to her under the Delicate Arch in Utah.
Wow.
That was my dirty little trick to get her to move here.
Wow, that's awesome.
But literally, Utah's a dry state, right?
Well, you know, I hear that from everybody, and it's dry water-wise, but there's plenty of alcohol here, and we've got plenty of bars, and that's more perception than reality.
That's what I kind of wondered.
But it's a wonderful place to start a distillery, actually, because we have a lot of visitors that come here to ski, and they're all thirsty.
That's great.
So how did you get the distillery started?
Well, it first started as a passion and a quest after an aha moment that I had in Kentucky. We went to a distillery there, and the barrel warehouse is really where the aha moment was, and right then and there when I smelled the whiskey evaporating from the wood, I told my wife, you know, I think this is what I want to do.
That's great.
But a few other things led up to it. I started my career as a biochemist, and my wife and I worked in biotech companies, and making whiskey is really just biotechnology, so it was really kind of the same thing. And, you know, how you make biotech drugs at our companies, you grow up yeast that has a gene inserted in them, and yeast already have a gene inserted in them for ethanol, which is a depressant, but it's just another drug like any other drug, and but you ingest it a little differently.
So from your biochemist friends at High West Distillery, what product was first?
Well, our first product was called Rendezvous Rye, and I was fortunate to meet the master distiller at Four Roses Distillery in Kentucky named Jim Rutledge. And he helped me with the business plan and the thinking. And, you know, it became very clear to us in the planning process that making whiskey and putting in wood and letting it age for a long time was a really hard business proposition. So Jim suggested we buy whiskeys from other distilleries and sell them as our own. I didn't really want to do that until I tasted some whiskey from the old Seagram's plant in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, which is now famous as LDI or MGP. And we blended some whiskey from there and some from Barton Distillery, some rye that nobody had ever had, and that created Rendezvous Rye, which we didn't know that the Malt Advocate, which is now a whiskey advocate owned by Wine Spectator, got a hold of the bottle and rated it 95 points, and that sort of put us on the map.
That's great. Good for you.
And when was this?
It was Christmas 2007, and Rendezvous Rye, you know, was kind of timely. Rendezvous Rye sort of tastes like Christmas to me. It's got that lovely mauling spice profile, and it really sort of changed the world of whiskey. This is a very different rye than most people had ever had, and all those ryes that were in it usually ended up getting blended into blended whiskeys or like Canadian-style whiskeys, and to have it straight on its own was a very different product proposition.
Yeah, the rye I grew up with, in Baltimore, Pikesville rye was the thing that everybody had, or the one that was supposed to be fancy was Old Overholt.
That's right.
So it's just funny to think about, you know, stocking a kid growing up working in the business, like stocking the liquor room in like 1980 with a case of Pikesville and a case of Old Overholt, and those are two things that never got restocked. What do you think is just the flavor of a lot of the products like Rendezvous Rye that's made whiskey come to everyone's attention again?
Well, there's no question everybody's really interested in whiskey now, and it sort of has an amazing heritage that, you know, I don't know if people really appreciated as much as they could have. But it certainly seems to be coming back in a big way, and people really are experimenting with or just challenging their palates with the different flavors that are available. And rye, you know, took us out of the bourbon realm with that spice profile.
You make some whiskeys now from your own grains or grains that you buy, or exactly how you're producing, because you guys have a variety of products now.
Yeah, we have a lot of products that you would call blends from outsourced whiskey. And then we started the company to distill our own, and we'll start to see some of those come out possibly next year. We make a rye whiskey our own. We make a malt whiskey, which is from malted barley, but we it's like scotch, but you call it malt whiskey here. And then we make a wheat whiskey that's our recreation of what the Mormon pioneers made. It was called Valley Tan, made from wheat. And hopefully that'll launch late next year, but it's a delicious light, floral, feminine whiskey that we really can't wait to start selling.
I have to ask a question. I don't understand what malted barley is. Can you explain that?
Oh, sure. When you malt any grain, that's where you take a seed and add water to it and get it to start growing. And as soon as it starts to grow, you essentially kill it by heating it. But that process where it starts to grow is called malting. And what that does is there's enzymes inside each grain that are there to unlock the starch source, and every living organism needs some source of energy, and for seeds it's starch, but you don't burn starch, you burn sugar. And those enzymes convert the starch to sugar, and that's called malt when you have that seed that's been slightly sprouted. And that's necessary in all beer making or whiskey making, because you need that malt to unlock the starches in any grain and convert the starch to sugar, essentially, which is what the yeast burn.
Great. Thank you for that.
Sure. Tastes wonderful, by the way.
I'm sure.
You've got a malted milkshake. It's the same thing that's in a malted milkshake.
See, that's the thing. I'm like, I can't figure out the malt thing. Okay. All right. Good.
And so, you know, malt is Scotch whiskey's made from malted barley, and different whiskeys are just made from different things, but almost all whiskeys have malted barley in them, but they might have predominantly some other grain.
Mm-hmm. So how about a little whiskey primer? Because it's funny, one of the reasons we're doing this program is because we always do a food and wine program, and then we've had a few moments recently where we realized that there are these giant currents of interest in beer and whiskey and coffee that are kind of the old, you know, all-American beverages that have been renewed to a great extent. But so for folks like us, how about a little primer on what are the couple of terms, five terms you should know about whiskey, like malted whiskey?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, I get this all the time. I have people say, well, I don't drink whiskey, I drink scotch. And you know, I have to say, well, scotch is a type of whiskey. So whiskey's anything that comes from grain. And so whiskey starts like this beer. If you ferment grain, you get beer. If you ferment grapes, you get wine. If you distill the wine, you get brandy. If you distill the beer, you get whiskey. So the different types of whiskey just come from different types of grain for the most part. So Scotch whiskey's from malted barley. Bourbon whiskey's predominantly corn. Rye whiskey's from rye. And then you can have quinoa whiskey or spelt whiskey or wheat whiskey. They don't tend to have the fancy names like Scotch and bourbon, but they can be used to make whiskey as well. Canadian whiskey can be made from anything, corn, wheat, or rye. Irish whiskey is made from unmalted barley. So it goes on and on. And you can do the predominant thing is, though, a grain ferments to beer, distilled beer, you have a whiskey.
And so then when you age whiskey, some folks, I've seen white whiskeys, I've seen whiskeys coming from all different kinds of barrels now. What are the typical profiles? What should you expect?
Well, so you mentioned white whiskey. All spirits, whether it's whiskey or tequila or rum, come out of the still clear, and then all the color comes from being in a barrel. And most governments around the world won't let you call it whiskey until it's been in wood. And in Scotland, that's a minimum of 3 years. In the United States, they don't have a minimum time. They just say it has to be stored in wood. So we don't have the equivalent thinking with whiskey, like with rum and tequila have Blanco and Añejo. Whiskey, we don't really have Blanco. Most people call Blanco moonshine for whiskey, but it's really just like Blanco rum or Blanco tequila. And then it's been in wood, it's Añejo. And then some places put the whiskey in sherry barrels, former bourbon barrels, brand new oak barrels, and those lead to different flavor profiles for the different whiskeys.
I think Cindy had some Blanco whiskey experiences in college in Indiana that led her to not drink a lot of whiskey since then.
Well, we were talking about how I don't really drink beer, and which I was hesitant to say in front of the nice men that were just on the show with us that are local brewers. And definitely some sort of whiskey thing. Definitely got me not enjoying it. But I'd like to taste all these things now because things have changed so much.
Well, indeed. I mean, education leads to appreciation, and learning what it is kind of helps. And not everybody loves white whiskey or unaged whiskey, but it can be quite delicious if it's been made well. And you'll certainly enjoy anything more once you learn a little bit about it.
Definitely. Well, you're so knowledgeable, and you are a wonderful teacher. I'm curious, when you put yours in barrel, what kind do you use, or do you use all different types, as you were saying?
It depends on what you want to make. So predominantly in the United States, we have what we call straight whiskeys, and that's a government term for quality, and there's certain things you have to do for the recipe to equal a straight. But a primary thing is it's aged in brand new oak. And so a couple of our whiskeys we age in brand new oak, and that lends to a different flavor profile, which is stronger in the wood flavor and caramel. And but the barrel can be used several times, just like a tea bag. The first time you use a tea bag, the tea can be quite strong, and you don't want to steep it too long. But you could use a tea bag a second time. Not everybody does, but you get the metaphor. The second time you use a tea bag, it's less intense because a lot of the flavor's already gone out in the first cup of tea. So the second cup of tea is not bad or worse or better. It's different. Same thing with a barrel. So when we get rid of our barrels here in the United States, we use them once typically, and we sell them to Scotland, Canada, Ireland, Mexico, the Caribbean, and most of the world's spirits are aged in used barrels. And so when we make our malt whiskey, which is like Scotch, we actually refill our used barrels that were made our rye whiskey. We make the rye whiskey with new wood, but our malt whiskey and our wheat whiskey we use used wood because we want a softer wood flavor profile.
Is that American oak, or what are you using?
We do use a lot of American oak, and to be straight whiskey, it has to use American white oak. However, you can use Hungarian oak or French oak or Spanish oak or Japanese oak. Obviously, we don't have a lot of those trees here, so it's harder for us, but we have some whiskeys. We do age in Hungarian oak for mouthfeel. One of our whiskeys is called Campfire, and it's actually a mixture of different whiskeys. We actually have a Scotch whiskey we buy for some smoke, but then we finish the whiskey in Hungarian and French oak. French oak adds a spicy profile, and tannins, and Hungarian oak adds mouthfeel, which is very different than American oak, which has a lot of vanilla in it.
The campfire is one of those things that I first time I tasted it, I'm like, that's exactly the right name for it. It's good to hear exactly what sort of the cocktail is that makes up that particular spirit, because that is not a usual spirit.
It's unusual. I'm glad you like it. It's actually a blend of bourbon, rye, and scotch, and the bourbon is sweet, the rye is spicy, and the scotch is smoky. Not all scotch is smoky, but the particular one we use is. And you know, people say, well, you can't mix bourbon and scotch. That sounds horrible. But the idea of sweet and smoke, that they're wonderful companions on your palate, and we do that all the time. You call it barbecue. So you can have a smoky barbecue with a sweet sauce, and again, sweet and smoke are wonderful companions on the palate. So that was definitely kind of the inspiration behind the campfire whiskey.
That's great.
So food-wise, here's your shot to play, Chef. So food-wise, David, what is your favorite thing to eat with the campfire, and in what form would you be serving the campfire?
Well, you know, any form is possible. I like most of my whiskeys neat in general. And, you know, whiskey, you can pair with food, and it's it doesn't go with everything, you know, just like not all wines go with everything and not all beer goes with everything. But I do find that I like whiskey with rich, fatty foods or smoky barbecue-type heavy foods. And so a neat whiskey, which is often low with caramel and vanilla, with a heavy, fatty dish, it's a nice complement, like putting salt and pepper on a steak. So I like whiskey with steak or barbecue.
Yeah, I always kind of imagined having that cowboy steak standing at the bar, you know, off a wood fire and having a nice fat glass of campfire, and then
sounds perfect.
Walking a very short distance afterwards.
Yes. But my other favorite food with whiskey is dessert. And again, the profile of most whiskeys is loaded with vanilla and caramel, and we all know what goes well with vanilla and caramel, kind of rich, sweet desserts. And I think whiskey is probably the most underrated thing on the restaurant menus. You know, cognac and sherry and port get all the glory, but I would suggest an American whiskey on a dessert menu would go very well.
That sounds pretty darn good. David, thanks for coming on the program with us.
Yes, thank you so much. It was nice to talk with you.
Well, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I look forward to coming to Baltimore to visit y'all.
That would be terrific. Hope to see you soon.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
That was pretty fun to have David on there.
That was great. Oh, my gosh.
The microbiologist distiller.
He's fascinating. Oh, my gosh.
With the Rocky Mountain twang, seems like that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. When we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll have our last segment with Vincent Iatesta from Ceremony Coffee Roasters. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And in our All-American Beverage Series today, we had our whiskey maker, we had our brewer.
Mm-hmm. And now we have something you can start your day with.
Yeah, we've kind of gone slightly backwards,
carefully.
I guess.
Carefully.
But then the sort of third ubiquitous American beverage product, coffee, right? We said right at the beginning of the program, it was no Boston coffee party. It was a tea party. And that the fashion came out of, you know, response, the reactionary response to rebelling against the tea drinking of the Brits.
Right.
So, and with us we have Vincent Iatesta from Ceremony Coffee Roasters. And you know the complete history of the coffee bean and all of its cultivation, don't you?
For the most part, yes.
No, this is not exactly a quiz show. We've been talking recently, and we always do the program on Food and Wine. And that's the music we know in great detail. But some of the other things that surround it are not our area of expertise, and we're thinking that, you know what, there got to be other people. Like, we've not covered these things or brought people who really know them to cover them to talk about the products, and so thanks for being on the show.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
So how in the world did you get into not drinking coffee but deciding to be in the coffee business? I mean, did you just open a coffee shop and bang?
Well, no, not quite like that. But, you know, I think it's a lot of things that came together at the right time for me. I actually, you know, I mean, I started drinking coffee in college as a way to stay awake and cram for exams and write papers. And I can assure you it was nothing very good. So it was more or less just a caffeine delivery system for me. But I was in grad school doing my MBA, and I was in Europe doing an international marketing segment for a couple of months. And it opened my eyes to coffee. I can't say it was the best, but at the time it was dramatically better than what I was consuming. So it really kind of opened my eyes and piqued my interest. And so when I came home, it became a hobby of mine. And, you know, I really got into it and researched it and, you know, played around with coffee. So I was actually in healthcare doing mergers and acquisitions and kind of grew tired of the corporate job and had an entrepreneurial fire in my belly that I wanted to do something with. And coffee seemed like a natural progression because at the time there was a kind of a proliferation of, you know, coffee shops, specialty coffee shops. Starbucks, you know, was moving east at the time and we started seeing them on the East Coast. And it seemed like a good time to get into it. It was something I was very interested in. And, you know, I always knew that if you wanted to be an entrepreneur and have a business, there's nothing better than doing something you love and being able to make a career out of it.
You better love it because it's not going to be easy.
That's right.
As we know that from the restaurant business. Sure. So yeah.
It becomes, you know, following your heart and becomes a passion, and you put in a lot of time and energy and work into making it successful. So,
have you ever traveled to see the plants growing?
Absolutely. Many, many times. I actually travel there every year to different origins. My last was in Colombia. But I've had a lot of wonderful experiences at Origin sourcing coffee, and working directly with farmers, with producers, you know, trying to get on the same page about quality and doing experimental lots. You know, we really like to push the boundary when it comes to coffee. So, you know, we're interested in different types of fermentation processes and micro lots, lot separation, you know, and different things like that. So
how does coffee get made?
How does coffee get made?
Well, exactly. Yeah. What are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5
And
step?
I can see out of Africa right now. Okay. I can see the big bins with the berry. Go ahead. Sorry. I'll let you talk.
No. That's a great start because Africa is where coffee's from. That's the origin of coffee. But coffee is it's the seed of a fruit. And it's a small evergreen tree that produces a fruit about the size of a cranberry. And when it's red and ripe, like a cranberry, you know, it's reached maturity. It's harvested at its peak maturity. And it's mostly in Arabica bean. High-grown specialty coffee is usually grown in the shade on mountains at elevations between 4,000 and 6,000 feet.
So really easy to cultivate.
Very easy to cultivate, yes. It's all picked by hand. And
wow.
You know, it takes a lot of labor. They pick it into baskets, and then they usually cull through the beans that they pick to sort it out and separate out. I mean, no matter how careful you are, you're still going to get some underripes or overripes in your basket.
So the coffee beans are really seeds.
They're really seeds, yep. And so the next thing you do in a washed process is you would strip away the skin and the meat from the seed. So the seed's going to occupy probably 90%, 85, 90% of the actual. There's not a whole lot of meat on there, but there is some, you know, right under the skin. And so it goes into a pulper, and it pulps it and removes the skin, removes the meat. And then it would sit in a fermentation tank for about 18 hours to let the sugars process and loosen up the meat and before being washed and going to a drying patio. Depending where you are, they use different techniques. But, you know, mostly in Central America, they use a lot of drying patios. So that they're large concrete patios that they'll spread out the beans on, let it dry to about 11 to 12% moisture.
How long does that take?
Well, it depends on the conditions. You know, if you don't have any rain, you know, depending on the humidity and the moisture level, it can take a few days. It can take a week.
Okay.
You know, a lot of places, like in Colombia, they have raised patios, so you get air coming in underneath through a screen, but then it's sheltered with like a plastic roof, so that, you know, if you do, it's pretty common to get little showers in the afternoon, and that way it would protect the, not let the beans get wet, mm-hmm. And procure the drying process.
But, makes sense.
Yeah. But there's all sorts of, like, you know, raised beds, you know, versus concrete, and there's different thoughts about, you know, they contribute differently to the processing. The processing is very huge. I mean, it can really dramatically change the taste of the coffee, you know, just in the way that it's processed.
So when the beans have dried to 11-12% humidity and they're ready to leave that patio?
Yes, they would go, they would bag them up, and they go into reposo, which means rest. So, and they're going to rest in a warehouse that gets good air ventilation, you know, for depending, again, where and the hardness of the bean, you know, it's typically between 45 and 90 days. And then it would go to the dry milling process where additional sorting and polishing takes place. So it has kind of like a hard outer shell. We call it a pergamino. And we pull off that shell off the bean. And then it goes through a lot of different sorting mechanisms through density sorters, screen size sorters. So you sort by size, you sort by density. And then typically optical sorters to look for additional defects, whether they're little chips or breaks in the bean. And then sometimes polishing machines that'll, you know, remove kind of like a tiny little silver skin that's on the bean before being bagged and, you know, ready for export. Wow. And those are the different grades. And usually the it's kind of funny because you travel to origin to some of the best coffee producing regions in the world, and it's hard to find a good cup of coffee. The irony there is they export all of their best yeah. product and they keep the triage for themselves wow. and brew it locally.
Huh, interesting.
That's nuts. Well, thanks for the lesson. So when you get product, what do you do with it when you get beans shipped to you?
When we get, you know, we work through importers, and so typically, you know, we do a lot of direct trade working directly with farmers, but then we always involve an importer because they provide a very valuable service for us. So they'll arrange for the, you know, the actual export and the cargo. It comes over on a ship, you know, on a cargo ship, and then it goes into their warehouse, and then we'll usually get arrival samples and test it, you know, to make sure it's going to meet our quality standards. And then once we get that, we'll either take delivery of the full lot that we purchased, or, you know, they may warehouse some of it for us and we'll take it as we need it. But we work with the entire chain. So starting with, you know, how the coffee is bagged, you know, so we've been working on, you know, better bagging. You can kind of envision, you know, Juan Valdez with burlap bags over the donkey, you know, back, you know, and some of that marketing. But today we use, it's called like a grain pro bag, and it's a multi-layer poly bag that's inside of a kind of a sisal or bag. And that way it protects the bean against changes in humidity, and it also protects the bean against absorbing flavors or aromas from burlap, because burlap
has a big smell.
It's probably not nice in your coffee.
Right.
It's not a real desirable flavor.
And that's something yeah. to think about with coffee, is how it absorbs other odors so easily, right?
Right. Well, it is a dried. It's kind of like a dried legume, you know, and it is going to absorb flavors. So we really want to protect, you know, how that coffee is transported, what kind of climactic conditions it's in once it arrives, and to preserve that flavor and keep it as pure as possible. So we'll decide whether we take the whole thing or leave some of it in the coffee warehouse. We have a warehouse that we, you know, have climate control in and good controls over the storage practices. So lots of times we'll take a full container and right into our warehouse and store it there because we can have better control.
So what kind of coffee do you love to drink and what kind of coffee do you hate to drink?
Well, my personal favorite is, I love African coffees. I like Ethiopians. Probably closest to my heart. They're just beautiful. They're typically kind of heirloom varietals. So you get a lot of different varietals, but they're all heirlooms because they used to grow wild in the forest there. You get a lot of complexity. You get a lot of depth, but you also get a lot of brightness and nice acidity to it. It's not a real heavy-bodied coffee.
I always thought there was a certain fruitiness almost to
in many cases,
some of those that
yes.
I've had a chance to taste.
Yeah, a lot of the African coffees do have fruity characteristics, and they can range from, like, Kenyans tend to have, like, a tomato-y kind of flavor, whereas washed Ethiopians might take on more of a citric, like a Meyer lemon kind of flavor, all the way to a natural processed Ethiopian, which might taste more like blueberries or some ripe fruit.
When you think
some winey characteristics.
But picturing the actual fruit of the tree, it's made from fruit. You would expect at some point it should taste something like fruit.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And in the natural process, they actually leave the fruit on the seed when they dry it, and then that way it picks up some more of those enzymatic flavors, and the sugars, you know, kind of get absorbed by the bean itself, and so it takes on more fruity notes when you use that process.
And the kind of coffee that you hate?
The kind of coffee I hate? Well, you know, I guess that could go in a couple of directions. one would directly related to the coffee itself, and it would probably more so than any particular origin, I would say it's related to perhaps the processing of the coffee or the quality of the coffee. So poor quality coffee is going to tend to taste harsh, and you know, maybe it might have some Robusta in there, which kind of gives a very kind of harsh off flavor. Some coffees you can find that might have some medicinal or rubbery notes, you know, and they're very undesirable, and that's just a quality issue. Then there's also a coffee that I really dislike that's from a roasting process, which is what we do as roasters. You know, we're not making the coffee, I can't change the quality, but I can change how it's roasted. And so I'm not a big fan of dark roasted coffee. I know a lot of people are, but you know, for me, dark roasted coffee is just burning coffee. And so if you like your toast burnt, or you like your meat burnt and well done and burnt, you know, then, you know, that's kind of an analogy to really dark roasted coffee, and that's just not how I like it. So those would be the two coffees that I don't really care for.
Thanks for coming on the program with us.
Absolutely.
Super interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It occurs to me, Sind, it's funny, I was listening to all of our guests today, thinking about the evolution sort of since the end of World War II until now, because all of these products have been around since long before that, but it seemed like they became ubiquitous right in the age of when television started to become ubiquitous, and there were only three channels, right?
Right.
And then all of a sudden, the last however many years, you have thousands of channels and a million different voices and a million different ways to entertain yourself. And it seems like those three American products, whiskey and beer and coffee, it seems like all of a sudden they've blown up just like, you know,
channels.
Just like another piece of our culture. Yeah.
Right, right. There's so many choices, exactly. It's interesting.
That's all we have time for today on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. If you want to download this program or any of our prior broadcasts, you can go to the WYPR website and look for the Formula Wolf page and check out all the podcasts that are there. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media, you can.
You can follow me on Twitter at Chef Cindy Wolf or on Instagram at Chef Wolf.
And for any questions, comments, you can email us, formanwolf@wypr.org. Thanks so much for listening.
And have a great Sunday.